Case number 13-7004, Commissions Import Export SA Appellant versus Republic of the Congo et al. Mr. Vasquez for the appellant, Mr. Morag for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Frank Vasquez, and I'm here with my colleague, Jonathan Ulrich. We're from White & Case, arguing on behalf of Commissions Import Export. I'd like to begin by addressing the two questions the court Ray asked us to address in its order of March 3rd that came last Friday. The first question was whether D.C. Code Section 13-364C allows the court the discretion to reject the English judgment in this case on the grounds that it violates public policy because it's enforcing an arbitral award. We think the answer to that is no, and let me just go through the authorities I've got here. One note on this statute was enacted by the D.C. Council in 2011, and it implements the Uniform Law of 2005. D.C. had formerly been under the Uniform Law of 1962. If we look at the Termarillo case that the parties have cited for a different proposition than this one, but also this the public policy exception is discussed there. That's at 487 F3rd at page 938 is the pin site. And the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in that case said that the standard for the public policy exception is extremely high and infrequently met, and only in clear-cut cases ought it to avail the defendant. If you look at the commentary to the Uniform Law, which is dated February 10, 2006, it also says that a difference in law, even a marked one, is not sufficient to raise the public policy issue, nor is it relevant that the foreign law allows a recovery that the foreign state would not allow. That is also, there's also a useful guide. The Federal Judicial Center put out an international litigation guide dated April 2012 about the recognition and enforcement of foreign judgments by Professor Brand that says similar things. In practice, this prohibition has really only been applied in unique circumstances, such as defamation cases that were found to be in conflict with the First Amendment. It really has not been applied in any circumstances that are remotely similar to ours. This circuit has generally rejected it, even under the old statute. If you look at the Society of Lloyds case that we both cited, that's at 457 F3rd at page 100, where this is discussed. So where we come out on that is, yes, it could be raised, but the decision should be made in our favor. And, in fact, courts in this circuit and in other circuits have already enforced these kinds of judgments based on foreign arbitral awards.
So you're not arguing the question was forfeited?
I am arguing. That's the second question. Yeah. And I believe it is forfeited because the if you look at that new statute, it's got a new Section D. And that Section D puts the burden squarely on the party opposing enforcement. And that's new for the 2011 section. And the Congo never raised that defense either in its answer or the opposition to summary judgment. So we do, in fact, believe it has been waived. We also see in the more general law regarding summary judgment, the case United Mine Workers of America, 1974 Pension Trust versus Pittston Company, reported at 984 F2nd 469 and PIN 478. That's a D.C. Circuit case of 1993, says that a failure to raise a defense in opposition to an affirmative defense in opposition to a motion for summary judgment constitutes an abandonment of that defense. And that's been followed very recently in Barnes v. District of Columbia, reported at 270 FRD 21, PIN site 23. That's a district court case from here in 2010. And so we do believe that regardless of the outcome of the first question, on the second question, the Congo has waived that that by not asserting it in opposition to our summary judgment motion. But obviously we don't get to those questions until we get past the preemption issue that is before the court on the main briefing. And when we look at that question, I think we need to start with the language of the statute, 9 U.S.C. Section 207, which says that a party may apply to a court having jurisdiction under this chapter or in order to confirm the award. And the question comes down to what does that may apply language mean, and is that intended to preempt state statutes? That I should have read the first part of that. It says within 3 years, which is the statute of limitations that's at issue. Now, this language is grafted from another part of the statute, Section 9, that's almost identical, which is for domestic awards. It says any time within 1 year after the award is made, a party may apply to a court to confirm the award. Now, courts have uniformly said that this language was intended only to apply to the enforcement efforts under the FAA itself. If you look at the Supreme Court.
Can I go back and just ask you about
how
parallel 9 and 207 really are? 9 talks about parties specifying courts and then going to the court so specified. And I assume you would agree that language in 9 U.S.C. 9 applies to state or federal courts. And the language in 207 talks about courts having jurisdiction under this chapter, and the chapter creates federal court jurisdiction. So it seems to me there's a lot of dissimilarities between the two of them. And I'm trying to understand how that impacts what Congress was doing here.
Well, I think they're dissimilar in the way you just described, but I don't think they're dissimilar in the manner in which they have been implemented, which is to say that both of these are intended to have statute of limitations that apply to applications under the particular sections. The way the FAA is structured is to give parties a streamlined way of enforcing arbitral awards, but it's not intended to be the exclusive way of enforcing arbitral awards, but you do get sort of this nice streamlined process where you can put in a petition under the FAA to enforce your arbitral award, whereas in this case we had to file a complaint. There was a summary judgment. There were more defenses that could be raised.
Well, I think there you're talking about the difference between enforcing the award and enforcing a judgment, but I want to get back to what I thought was a pretty important predicate of your entire argument, and that was the assumption that 207 really parallels 9 U.S.C. 9, but it seems to me there's some serious structural differences here, all of which point to a desire for an increased federal role and potentially federal control when it involves foreign arbitral awards. So we have the language here, which isn't any court that they specify. It's not necessarily, you tell me if you disagree, state or federal in the way it is in 9 U.S.C. 9. You have Congress creating jurisdiction, which they didn't do under Chapter 1. You have Congress providing for removal to get these things into federal court, which they didn't do under Chapter 1. So it seems to me that's actually structurally very different than 9 U.S.C. 9 in ways that certainly imply at some level, and we'll decide whether it's enough, that Congress wanted more of a federal role or wanted to open the federal courts up a lot more when it involves foreign awards.
I agree that the Section 207, you have jurisdiction in federal courts, is that what we're talking about, whereas 9, you could go to either the state or a federal court, depending on the other jurisdictional analysis, although in a case like this one, we're dealing with a foreign sovereign, so it's a completely separate issue. But I still believe that language, in particular, that giving a party can say a party may apply to do this, does not say a party must apply to do this.
Nobody has to enforce an arbitration award. They can either hope that they'll be self-executed or voluntarily executed, but there's no obligation under law to go enforce an award. People may enforce judgments as well, but they don't have to. Isn't that all it means?
No, I don't think so, because the this is under the background of the New York Convention itself, which in Article 7 has a savings clause. And that article says that this is not intended to deprive a party of other rights that it may have. So we don't believe that...
rights it may have, right, to the extent allowed by the laws of the country. And so that just sort of begs the question. It doesn't deprive them of any rights that Congress didn't deprive them of, but that just begs the question in this case. Your Article 7 argument.
Yeah, well, we don't believe that Congress, though, intended to restrict the use of or the enforcement of awards or judgments is what we're really talking about here. That this statute was intended to do that. I think the Hall Street case, in particular, says that the FAA is not the only way into court for parties wanting review of arbitration awards. And we think that general principle applies both to Section 1 and Section 2.
Can I ask you, there's a second sentence in 9 U.S.C. 207. Obviously, you all been focused on the first sentence, which has the three-year time limit, but the second sentence has a limitation on confirmation if one of the grounds identified in, I think it's Article 5 of the Convention, substantive grounds for not enforcing an award, applies. And so my question is, if the first sentence is not preemptive, as you posit, does that mean the second sentence is not preemptive as well, and a state court could confirm an arbitral award even though it's something in its content violated Article 5 of the Convention? Or is your position that sentence 1 is not preemptive but sentence 2 is?
In sentence 2, it limits the power of a court to reject awards. And that was also discussed in that Termarillo case, that the question there is that there are only limited ways to avoid, for a court to avoid or reject an award, and those are in the they're in the convention when you're talking about foreign awards being brought to this country. Obviously, if you had an award that was made in this country, then that it could be rejected for other reasons under the law of the arbitration itself.
Well, I mean, are you saying that the second sentence is only, imagine we're in federal court. Would a federal court have the power to enforce an award if something in its process violated Article 5 of the Convention? I think it's both a confirm unless, but, you know, if Article 5 is triggered, don't confirm sentence.
Yeah.
This forbids confirmation if somebody violates Article 5, the sentence?
Yeah, it would have to find that one of the grounds for refusal in Article 5 applied.
And if you find one of those grounds, you can't confirm. Is that correct?
No, I don't know if that's correct.
Only
because some of those grounds have to be brought up by, and this may just go to this burden issue as to who's got to bring it up.
If
it's brought before the court and the court finds that it applies, then I agree with you. Yeah.
Then they couldn't enforce that award.
They should not.
Right. Could a state court enforce the award? Or is this sentence preemptive on states?
If somebody were to bring, I think this would apply to any court that is dealing with an arbitral award in particular. But none of this applies to.
The court here means, in the second sentence, means state and federal.
Well, it's court having jurisdiction. So, assuming the court has jurisdiction, that would be a question to be dealt with.
I'm just asking whether the court here is both state and federal, and so the second sentence would be preemptive. Because imagine a state X has a process for confirming awards. Arbitral awards, but it doesn't have the same list that Article 5 of the Convention does, and it's very laissez-faire about what it enforces. So it's willing to enforce an award even for a violation of something, a notice requirement in Article 5. So they want to enforce it, but Article 5 says don't enforce it. It's a state. Can they or not?
If you're talking about this statute, no. But if you're talking about their own statute, I don't think that this prohibits a state from applying its own law under its own statute if it also applied. I'm not sure there would be a situation where both you could be in a state court enforcing an award as opposed to a judgment that is applying this statute. At least I'm not aware of any cases where a state court would be applying Section 207. I do think, though, that this is not intended to be exclusive, that this provision, if there is a parallel track that you can follow, I think all the courts that have said this, have ruled on this, have said that this is not the only way to enforce your rights under an arbitral award.
Can you enforce? I know there's time issues here, but could someone have gone straight to state court? Could you have gone straight to D.C. after the French court confirmed the award and asked D.C. also to confirm the award?
If they had a statute that applied, but I don't think that...
They have a statute for confirming arbitration.
There is a statute that applies for confirming awards, but it would not apply to this kind of a judgment if you read the statute itself.
But if you had a state that said, we're happy to do foreign or domestic, we'll confirm arbitral awards, then they could. Or are you reading this as only a federal court and can confirm a foreign arbitral award?
I'm reading this statute that would... under this statute, I mean, it says any court having jurisdiction, in which, I mean, this is really applying to federal courts. I think that all the states have similar rules, if you will, under their arbitration enforcement provisions. Almost all of them, first of all, say that the parties have to opt into it. The issue almost can't arise unless both of those parties in France had said, we want District of Columbia law to our situation, then I think you could just go straight through the District of Columbia, because that would be enforcing, and that would another sort of theme of Federal Arbitration Act is we want to allow the parties to arbitrate in the way that they decided to arbitrate for the most part, and let them enforce those agreements.
Well, if there would be a problem with a state confirming an award that violated Article 5, just assume there would be a problem that the convention would not allow a state court to do that. Does it get any better if a state is simply enforcing a foreign judgment that was made confirming an award that violated Article 5? I mean, I'm asking about the sea transport case scenario from the Second Circuit.
Yeah, I think it is a whole different kettle of fish, if you will, when you're talking about states enforcing foreign judgments. That is an area that has traditionally been reserved to the states. That is an area where states have been allowed to decide when things are enforceable. And I think that these cases where the Solotron case and what follows from that, and even when you get to the Fifth Circuit case from last year, First Investment Corp. Reported at 703 F3rd 742 and 751, says flat out that judgments based on foreign arbitral awards can be a party armed with the latter may be able to circumvent the New York Convention's 3-year statute of limitations.
But what about the second sentence? Could imagine that you're going to the D.C. court, you're asking them just to enforce a judgment, but that judgment you want enforced is an arbitral award judgment from country X, and it confirmed an award clearly in violation of Article 5. Does the state court just go, we don't get to look at Article 5 of the convention, we're just going to enforce this judgment, or are they prohibited by this sentence from enforcing a judgment that violates the treaty?
I don't think, because the treaty applies to arbitral awards, it does not apply to judgments, that the state court would have to look at that.
The Second Circuit took a different approach, right? They've said, we're only going to allow this enforcement as long as the prior arbitral award was done consistently with the convention. That was a sort of photochrome and sea transport.
Yeah, I understand that.
So you're saying that's wrong, though. In fact, I should enforce it.
I'm saying that honestly, the grounds for non-enforcement are pretty much the same, particularly if you talk about public policy.
But I'm just assuming, what if they're not? I'm trying to figure out whether this sentence has some preemptive force, because otherwise there's a real circumvention concern about people being able to get out of limitations imposed by Article 5 and protections imposed by the convention just by hopscotching through an enforcement overseas and then enforcing that award as a judgment here in the United States. There's a real concern about that.
Well, I think, I mean, I would agree with that with the way the Second Circuit has viewed this is the correct view. But I think that this area of the law, and we would still argue that it's that the presumption of against preemption would apply in this case because of the nature of this kind of activity, which has been traditionally reserved to the state court functions and enforcing arbitral war. I'm sorry, enforcing foreign judgments.
But then we're in a very strange world in which you have a single statutory provision. One sentence would be non-preemptive, and the second sentence would be literally and practically, in its operation, preemptive. Are you aware of any situation where a statute has been held to have on and off preemptive force like that within a single statutory section?
Standing here right now, no, I'm not. I'm not sure I would view it the same way that you're viewing it. But I think we'd be going round and round if I were to.
So let me ask you, so I'm clear, following up on Judge Millett's questions, is it your position then that because this parallel enforcement mechanism exists under state laws, that all of the provisions in Section 207 are no obstacle to a state court under its own laws enforcing a foreign judgment that is based on an arbitral award?
Essentially, yes, that we don't believe that the convention or the FAA should be applied to the enforcement of foreign judgments. And there is a large body of law about the enforcement of foreign judgments. It's largely at the state level. It does parallel a lot of these issues.
And if you were writing the opinion, what would you do with the second sentence that Judge Millett has been discussing with you, second sentence in Section 207?
I think that we need to look at the whole purpose of this statute in Section 7, in Section 207, that the way this has been interpreted is to allow people more ways of enforcing their awards, essentially. The FAA has been implemented to allow more ways to enforce the award, not fewer ways to enforce the award.
In other words, would you read the second sentence then to be limited to a limitation on the courts as to the confirmation of an award?
Yes.
Only.
Yes, I would agree with that, and I would say that the first thing that has to happen is a party may apply in the first sentence. So if the party doesn't apply under this statute, then I don't think you'd be applying the rest of it.
Well, as you know from your opponent's brief, they argue heavily along this line that your position about a parallel procedure is inconsistent with the structure of Section 207 and the full purposes of Section 207. I can't speak for Judge Millett, obviously, but I think that's why at least I'm focusing in on that issue. I understand your parallel, you know, we're in a different world.
Yeah.
So we don't have to look at where we came from, in effect. And your opponents say, oh, no, you do have to. That, you know, you rely on the plain language of 207. And the argument that's being made is you're misreading it, or you're not giving it full force and effect, much less the full, all provisions of the statute.
I understand the argument, but I think it is correct, as you mentioned, that this is talking about the confirmation of an award here. It's not talking about the enforcement of a judgment.
So once the award is confirmed, that's the end of any protections under the New York Convention.
Well, this 3-year statute of limitations, yes, is designed to talk about confirming a foreign award. I think that it is not intended to apply essentially to other procedures or other statutes or other regimes.
And is your argument that if Congress had been concerned about this, it could easily have stated something along the lines of enforcement by a state of a foreign judgment based on an award is not permitted?
Exactly, that this, there's no language in the FAA that is explicitly preemptive, and the only places where the FAA has been found to preempt is when the state law at issue has been hostile to the enforcement rights under arbitral awards.
So that's why the focus, I suppose, on the second sentence here. Is there some hostility or obstacle to carrying out Congress's intent here?
I don't think so.
In other words, you lose your Article 5 defenses once a judgment is entered after confirmation of the award.
Yeah, you would have you would have the defenses that you have under the enforcement of judgment, including the public policy and on all the other things that are at issue. Article 5 itself is designed to limit the number of defenses that could be raised, and as this circuit has said, in the arguments that had been raised in some of the other cases in the past 10 years. The question has been, well, are there other defenses that could be raised to enforcement of awards, to restrict the enforcement of awards? And the answer has been no.
We're talking here about a deal between nations, right? A deal has been struck between foreign nations. And that deal is, if one of these things in Article 5 is violated, don't worry, it won't be enforced in our country. And for purposes of that foreign government, whether it's called enforcing the award or enforcing a judgment, enforcing the award, it's the exact same practical effect. And so the consequence of ignoring the second sentence when we do the end run through the enforcing judgment route is that you sort of a bait and switch with foreign governments, right? They've been promised, here's the deal. When you come to our country, don't worry, you have your Article 5 defenses, and now we go, except when you don't. All you have to do is enforce a judgment, launder it through another country, and then you can get it enforced heedless of what Article 5 says.
Well, I think you need to read Article 5 and Article 7 together, because Article 5, first of all, although this is an agreement between governments, we're talking about what parties have the right to do in both Article 5 and in Article 7. And Article 5 provides things that the parties might raise, but Article 7 says that this convention shall not deprive any interested party of any right that he might have to avail himself in the manner and to the extent allowed by law or other treaties.
But I think that just begs the question of what our law allows, which is this very, you know, we don't require express preemption, right? We have object and purpose preemption, and this feels to me, or at least I'm asking this question, how would you distinguish the type of preemption concerns that the Supreme Court had in Crosby in the Arizona case, where you have different techniques, different procedures can, in their operation, confound the purposes and objects of federal legislation, and we're particularly careful about that when you're dealing with foreign relations, foreign governments.
I think this gets us to a distinction between what the convention says and what the statute says. Obviously, the convention, as we just talked about, is designed to preserve the rights that parties have in their home countries, which in our country includes both the rights they would have under state law and the rights they would have under federal law. And then the question becomes, was this intended to supersede those other rights? And we don't see that the FAA has ever been read in that way. The FAA, if you look at the Ekstrom case from this circuit, has essentially been read as a one-way ratchet. And what I mean by that is, if you're talking about preemption, the question becomes, does this harm arbitration, or does it restrict the rights of people to enforce arbitral awards? And we would think that a reading of this that says that you can't enforce arbitral awards, which is urged by our opponent, is the wrong application. And I don't think that there's any court that I'm aware of that has applied the FAA in that manner, except for the district court here. This is the district court.
The Second Circuit in Photochrome and C-Transport.
Why don't we hear from counsel for appellees, and then we'll give you some time on rebuttal. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Your Honor should affirm the ruling of the district court that under the facts and circumstances of this case, Thomas Simpex's attempt to use state recognition law to domesticate the 2000 ICC award through the English judgment, which is what they said they were doing, is preempted by Section 207's three-year limitations period, which they acknowledged was a limitations period, which they acknowledged would preclude directly recognition of this arbitral award in the United States. In fact, what they said in their papers below that Chief Judge Lamberth relied on and noted twice in his opinion is that they conceded it was a limitations period and that, quote, any claim to enforce the 2000 award directly would be time barred by operation of 9 U.S.C. Section 207.
So that's your argument as to their first argument on appeal.
Yes.
How about their second argument?
Okay, I'm happy to get to their second argument, but I would like to spend just a few minutes on this issue.
I'm not suggesting you're waiving any arguments in your brief.
I understand.
All right.
With respect to the function of state law, I think it's important to explain the following. It is absolutely correct that the overriding principle of Volt is that the party's agreement to arbitrate should be enforced as they agree to it. It is undisputed in this case that there is no incorporation, no agreement by the parties for the application of any U.S. state law. You have an agreement to arbitrate between two Congolese entities in France under French law.
That's not exactly right. The convention recognized that there would be some signatory states that would have a federal system of government, and that, like ours, and in those countries, the federal government would be obligated to adopt implementing legislation.
Right.
But as to the states, or whatever the subunits are in any given country, all they had to do was essentially go and politely ask them to think about doing it. And so it seems to me that your client and countries around the nation signed up for a system in which, you know, when you're dealing with a country that has a federal system of government, you know, it might be a little different.
Right, but under our federal system of government principles of preemption, the question then becomes, what did the federal statute do? And our point is that although there is a role for state arbitration law, it is not a parallel system in the sense that you can go to one or either. If you've agreed to apply state law, state arbitration law, then those principles apply to you. That is the Ekstrom case. You agreed to arbitrate under Connecticut law, so Connecticut, the FAA authorizes that agreement, and therefore you're bound by both Connecticut limitations periods and the federal limitations periods.
No, but when that's a substantive arbitration. What I'm talking about is when it comes to the procedures for enforcing
right.
an award, they knew that there were going to be some risks in federal systems, countries that have federal systems of government, and nothing in the convention said you, signatory, have to make this the governing law within your country. It acknowledged that the subunits within that federal system might take a different path.
Well, but the United States has told the world community, told the United Nations when they asked how is the New York Convention adopted and applied in your country, it cited the federal legislation, it cited Chapter 2 of the FAA. It made no reference to state courts because I believe, and you've asked for the views of the Justice Department, that the Federal Act was intended to provide the sole means and has, in fact, in the last 40 years, provided the only means for enforcement of New York Convention arbitral awards in this country. There's not a single case that they can cite or that we can find where a state wants to enforce an arbitral award that's rendered abroad under a regime that would conflict or be any way different from what Chapter 2 says.
No, but to get to Judge Rogers' question, fine, let's just assume, for purposes of argument, preemption when it comes to enforcing an arbitral award.
Okay.
It would be extraordinary to take a statute and then say it not only preempts state action there, but it's going to preempt this entirely distinct state practice of enforcing foreign judgments that is very historic and very well-grounded in our country.
I'm happy to address that. First of all, let's be clear here. There was nothing to this English judgment other than the recognition of the judgment in the United Kingdom. As Your Honor observed in the Belize case, that decision is solely for purposes of that secondary jurisdiction and has no preclusive effect on a United States Court's decision with respect to the award itself. So one of the points we make is that it would be particularly inappropriate to treat this English judgment as having greater significance than it would if they brought the award in this country timely. Second, remember the concession or the statement below. All they were trying to do is domesticate the award through enforcement of the English judgment. There was nothing separate and apart. There is no separate decision made in this judgment that they're trying to enforce here. They also decided to argue that the award and the judgment were so closely related that the FSIA jurisdiction provision that provides for a waiver, an absence of immunity to enforce an arbitral award under the New York Convention should apply to this case because the judgment and the award were so intertwined and interlinked that they could avail themselves of that jurisdictional provision. This is clearly... That's point one. The next point is under all of the Hines progeny, obstacle, and conflict preemption cases. This is the doctrine you apply precisely when you have two different bodies of law, to see if, notwithstanding that they're in different bodies of law, judgments and awards, there is a frustration of congressional purpose here. And that's the definition of when you apply the doctrine. It's not the proof that there's no preemption. And so, why in Perez versus Campbell was a state regulation of driver's licenses found preempted by the bankruptcy code? Because it had the effect in the particular circumstance of saying that a judgment that had been discharged, you were still going to suffer consequences from it.
Part of the problem here is that this is all about enforcing ultimately the convention.
Yes.
If time limitation, I mean, this is really just about a time. Do you make any argument that Article 5 was violated?
No, Your Honor, but the point is...
So it's only about the time limit. The convention has no time limit, correct?
Correct. That's why the Fifth Circuit's decision that he mentioned is just wrong.
But the convention has no time limit. Doesn't that signify that the time for enforcement, which is really all this is a fight about, is not something that is that critical. And it's the type of thing where a signatory state could have a rule for its federal system of government and a different rule for its local governments.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's precisely the compromise that was made. This is the most successful commercial treaty that has ever existed and gotten the joinder of 146 states precisely because it allocated flexibility appropriately. And the flexibility it allocated was for each state to decide its own time limit. They range from 2 years to infinity.
Okay, but then so the United States could decide
it
the
could.
Time limit will be 3 years in some courts and whatever those other courts choose. I mean, the United States could have done that, correct?
It could have. Our position is they didn't.
Okay, but it could have done that. It would not violate the convention. So why should we assume that's not what they did, given our presumptions?
Precisely the reasons that are in our brief in terms of the differences between this chapter and the first chapter of the FAA. You have, first of all, an international treaty that Congress, that the President signed, and then Senate ratified, and then Congress passed enabling legislation. There is a presumption of uniformity in terms of how this is going to apply in the United States. That's in the legislative history, that they were looking for uniformity in the way this would apply. Second, you have a statement that this was going
is
to be...
Is legislative history enough to preempt states? Don't we need to look either in the text, we either need to find it in the text and express one, or we need to find that the two cannot coexist? And given, again, that you said it would be perfectly fine under the convention to have two different tiers going within a federal system, I don't know how we could find objects and purposes.
Well, Your Honor, you can, because, first of all, the baseline principles here, and remember what this was also briefed against the context, and we argued, and the other side did not challenge, Chief Judge Lambert's decision in the Flatow case, in which he held that an arbitral award subject to the convention that's not confirmed in the United States is null and void in this country.
That hasn't gone up to this court, though.
It has not. Okay. But they didn't challenge the premise either. We would also point out textually that this statute, 9 U.S.C. 201, says that the convention, the New York Convention, shall be enforced in United States courts in accordance with this chapter. That is a curious formulation of the term. United States courts, we've found, is not the term of art for federal courts. That term of art is courts of the United States. And Southland case discusses that term of art in discussing Chapter 1 and why Chapter 1 doesn't necessarily apply in state courts or certain provisions of it don't apply in state courts. United States courts is a different formulation.
So that means everything in Chapter 2 is preempted?
Yes, because the only thing it does is establish that you're not going to adopt different standards from the convention for recognizing the awards, which is the commitment the United States made in signing the document.
There's no different standard from the convention here. The convention doesn't say anything about statutes of limitations.
Right. I'm talking about your questions to opposing counsel with respect to the Article 5 grounds.
Right. But you don't assert that here.
We don't.
You have to decide that here.
Correct. But the point is that that is the effect of this statute, is to preempt states. I mean, from adopting different standards from the New York Convention with respect to a convention-governed award.
Could you, to figure out, is this, given your reading of 201, does that mean that the federal government has completely occupied the field when it comes to enforcing foreign arbitral awards?
No, because...
Maybe this is an express preemption provision or an occupation of the field?
I don't think there is an actual... test for occupation of the field. It has said that cases can be filed in state courts. It has said that they're subject to removal. This is like the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. If you're still in state court, you still have the substantive federal standards for immunity that apply there. You still have the substantive federal standards that are adopted in the convention for which awards you can choose not to enforce. So, yes, I believe is the answer to your question. And so the point is that our view is that this is simply the same kind of evasion of the limitations period. Now, think about also what is the purpose of a limitations period. This Court has been very consistent that limitations period reflects a public policy of the legislature to cut off rights, to provide for repose. Everyone understands that an arbitral award is not self-executing. It has to be converted into a judgment in order for it to be enforced. If that is necessary, that's why the person may apply to the court for an enforceable judgment. If that is necessary, every jurisdiction in the world has a time limit to do that in. It's time to decide whether you've got a judgment or not. Congress chose 3 years. Once, and it was cognizant of the one-year statute in 9 U.S.C. 9.
Now, to the extent you're not arguing the Article 5 point, what other aspect of the convention is adversely affected by recognizing this parallel enforcement procedure?
Recognizing the parallel enforcement procedure is antithetical to the whole notion of the convention, frankly.
Well, you want me to look at the legislative history.
I want you to look at the Belize.
No. I'm just saying, in your brief, and just now in answering to Judge Millett, you cite the legislative history. So I looked at it. That doesn't help your case. I mean, I don't think it helps either side's case as a practical matter. But, I mean, there is that statement, this doesn't in any way take away any rights you have under state law. That's about the clearest statement in the legislative history. So going on, the Belize case, question of to stay, could a foreign court stay the arbitration in the federal court? I mean, I think that case is somewhat distinguishable, but I get the point you're trying to make by it. But just conceptually tell me what is sort of undermined by once, as it were, just chronologically, if you look at it with it that way, everything under the convention is complete. All right, now the question is collecting the award. So you get a judgment, all right, and you try to find the resources collect on the award. Now, does the convention say anything about that?
Yes, it does.
And what does it say?
It says that, and this is what the Karaha Botis cases from the Fifth Circuit established, that the fact that another court, another secondary jurisdiction, here in the United Kingdom, has recognized the judgment, or I'm sorry, has recognized the award in that country, has no impact, is not res judicata, is not collateral estoppel, is not issue preclusive with respect to each other country's obligation to look at the award and decide whether to enforce it. That is the fundamental premise of the New York Convention, that it permits each country to decide, consistent with its own procedural rules, whether an arbitral award is to be enforced. That is why you have multiple proceedings in each country, why you don't take one judgment from one country and use that. And this has never been done before.
And so, repeat for me your response to Judge Millett's question about the federal systems that were obviously recognized by the various countries joining the convention.
The United States decided, I mean, again, if this presumption against preemption were also powerful, which, by the way, it's a rebuttable presumption. They contend in their brief that it's dispositive, which I don't even understand how that can be dispositive. But we're dealing with a situation here where the United States has made the decision how to apply the New York Convention. The question is, this is basic. This is a federal law that therefore preempts anything that conflicts with it. I mean, and here they've decided, Congress has decided to adopt a time limitation that has the effect of cutting off the vitality of that award.
I guess your answer, it just seems to beg the question of what the federal government answer is on statute of limitations. It is either, as you posit, 3 years, that's it. Anybody in the United States in any form is stuck with our 3 years rule. Or Congress said 3 years for a federal court, state rules for state courts.
But there is no.
Which it was.
But there is. But by the way, it's not like there is some state court that has an arbitration act that would have applied to this award, that has a longer period that would have permitted them to enforce the award. That is the fundamental fallacy in
no jurisdiction in this country has more than 3 years for enforcing an arbitral award.
Not a foreign one. And that is because the state courts, if you look at state court opinions that discuss foreign awards, they recognize that this is a New York Convention award and that they don't have the right to without an agreement by the parties, to adopt New York, some state law that applies, either because they wanted to arbitrate there or they specifically chose it.
So your argument in part is that in this case, because of the FSIA argument, this court should view the foreign judgment as nothing more than the confirmation of an award, that it's not an independent, legally enforceable object.
I believe that's because of the New York Convention in Chapter 2, not because of the FSIA. The same would apply in a private
party. No, what I meant about the FSIA is what I asked you earlier was whether, looking at the plain text of Section 207, it was talking simply about the confirmation of an award, all right? It says nothing about enforcement of judgments and enforcement of foreign judgments. I'm just saying the plain text doesn't say that. You may be right for other reasons.
Yes.
But I don't see a sentence in there that says, and this means you can't go into any of our states seeking enforcement of a foreign judgment. The words aren't there.
The words are not there.
It may have intended that, but I need to understand your argument here. And I thought part of it was, well, plaintiffs have already conceded this because they say the judgment is nothing other than the award.
That's part.
All right, so therefore we ought to look at that second sentence and say this is the end of the case. All right? The other argument I thought you were making was that the one that the district court adopted, basically, and you're end running, and Congress never anticipated that this would be a way to get around the 3-year statute of limitations.
Correct.
So if Congress never contemplated it, and yet there was evidence that Congress was directly confronted with the fact that rights do exist under state laws, and Congress chose to be silent on the issue, how do we get to your basically tantamount to occupy the field? Congress has acted, that's the end of the matter.
Because, first of all, I do believe that that legislative history is referring to rights, and the particular right that the senator was inquiring about was, does this force anything on anyone?
I don't want to argue legislative history because I just don't think it's that helpful, but my only point in bringing it up again was Congress is directly confronted with this question about rights that you may have under state law, and yet it was silent when it decided how it wanted to implement the treaty provision.
I think it was silent in part because no one had ever thought to take a judgment on an award and bring that to the country. That had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
The second point is that, and you can say this is too cuts both ways, but I do think it's important. In the piece of the legislative history about the 3 years versus the 1 year, the specific statement is that we anticipate that it's possible and likely that there would be enforcement activities abroad, and that's why we need to give more time. Enforcement activities abroad means there would be a judgment from some other court confirming this award. And yet, what Congress meant to do was implement the convention which looks at the award. It is always better to look at the decision that resolves the dispute, as opposed to what we've got here, which is a one-page thing that just says the award and some numbers, and you have no idea. And no court has ever really looked at that just one piece of paper and said, are there any defenses under the Recognition Act, Judgment Recognition Act? Every Second Circuit case that professes to look at either one goes to the underlying issue of what happened in the arbitration and the arbitrator's decision.
Well, but, you know, the argument could be if you had a state law that said we're only going to enforce a foreign judgment if we find, in fact, that the Article 5 defenses were accorded to the parties, all right? I mean, I don't see how that gets us over the basic.
But then that state law doesn't change anything. I mean, the whole point here is the conflict. And the only potential opportunity for conflict is when the parties adopt and agree to be bound by state law. That is what Hall Street says. Why didn't the parties get their chance to have the district court review under the standard of review that they wanted? Because that's not what the federal law states, and they didn't incorporate state common or statutory law in their agreement. And that is clearly our case as well. We did not either. So the only game in town is the Federal Arbitration Act Chapter 2 for foreign arbitral awards where the parties have not adopted or incorporated a state law by virtue of arbitrating here or saying specifically.
Let me ask you a bit of a different question. The UK award here actually changed somewhat significantly what the arbitral award was, right? It added interest, but then subtracted out a large amount of money that I guess that you all found you had collected.
No, I mean, that it didn't subtract. It acknowledged that there had been a collection. But all it did, it didn't change the award at all. It simply brought the exact same principal amount of interest forward.
It changed essentially the dollar amount of the award.
Didn't it reduce it?
Yeah.
No, well, it increased it overall.
It changed. It's a different dollar award than what you had coming out of France. But they had coming out of France.
But that would be true of the award itself if they had collected something on it. That the collection is not the important.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out if that makes it almost, for these purposes, like what they're trying to do here is enforce that arbitral award.
I don't believe so, because they've said that the only purpose of their action here was to domesticate the award. And that's why they attach the award to their complaint.
Which award are they domesticating? Because if the UK award is a different award than the French award, then are they domesticating the award, or are they actually enforcing a new arbitral award from?
No, the award refers to the ICC Paris 2000 document. The French court then rendered a judgment. The English court rendered a judgment. But what they say they're trying to do is domesticate the award, the 2000 award, the long document signed by the arbitrators. So that's what they say they're doing here. If I could just address for 2 seconds the 15364C issue. Again, we were a little confused by the question because, I mean, clearly, to the extent that that provision refers to U.S. public policy and refers to, and that incorporates concepts of preemption, we made that argument, but it really doesn't change any of the analysis. You would still reach the preemption point, and we think you should reach the preemption point. We did not make the argument that the question itself actually suggested, that somehow this act of Judgment Recognition Act does not apply to any arbitral award, timely, untimely, conforming with the defenses of Article 5 or not. And obviously the reason we didn't make that argument is because we don't have that case here. We have a case where you do have a conflict, and it's between the effectively indefinite or at least 15-year limitations period of the D.C. Act and the Section 207 of the FAA.
I guess what, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to go back to this earlier question. Just stay with me for a moment on a hypothetical.
Okay.
The arbitration is completed. All right? You have, your client has lost. All right? So the winning party now tries to collect the amount that the arbitration has said is owed. So the first thing they do is to get, and I'll get the terms wrong, but they get the French court to recognize the award, and they try to collect. And they're unsuccessful in collecting all of the amount that's due. So then they go to Belgium and they try to collect it. That's unsuccessful. So then they go to England. And while the matter is pending in England, some resources are discovered in France. So the English court says, okay, we will deduct the amount that's been collected and say there's a judgment for the remaining amount that's due. I want to be clear, just from your perspective, why Congress would be concerned about the collection end once the arbitration proceedings are over and a party having prevailed in that proceeding is now trying to collect under that proceeding.
The answer is because the arbitral award to be enforced, to be collected non-voluntarily.
No, my hypothetical is we're not talking about the award qua award. All right, you now have a judgment, all right, of a foreign court, whether we want to look at it as the French, in my hypothetical, whether it's the French court judgment or the English court judgment. And the argument, as I understand it, is even though you have, in my hypothetical, been persistent in trying to collect on this award, you're out of luck. That judgment that you received from the English court is a nullity insofar as the United States is concerned.
It's not a nullity. It's simply that just like the
text... Well, it's a nullity in the sense you can't enforce it in this country, and therefore you can't collect what is left outstanding on the award.
Right. And it is the same principle that the Texas court in the Redding and Bates case that we cite said. You don't outsource to another jurisdiction the obligation to review the underlying decision. In the case of arbitral awards, they are different from court judgments. They don't have
full faith and credit. But that's the deal. If you agree to arbitration,
right,
you're giving up a lot of procedures and rights that you may have had you gone to court. So now you've completed the arbitration proceeding, and one party has prevailed, or not. But at any rate, whatever the arbitrator has said.
But under the New York Convention,
yes,
completing the arbitration in this country,
yes,
completing the arbitration in France has no effect on the enforcement of the rights in this country.
So
every
country.
Just
so you understand where I'm, just so I'm clear. A party prevails in an arbitration.
Yes.
It gets a judgment. Is Congress contemplating that upon getting that judgment, where you don't necessarily know where the losing party's assets are located and you're trying to find them, that you basically have to go to every jurisdiction that potentially might
in the case
be
of
a source and file within, in our case, the 3 years, or you're out, and under Flatow, the award, for all intents and purposes, is null and void.
In the case of arbitral awards, yes, that is the premise of the Belize decision and the Caraja-Botas cases. That is why the court specifically recognizes the possibility of multiplicity of proceedings under the same award. We also cited the Rosneft-Yukos cases. That is an instance of the same award being considered by multiple countries, despite judgments in one country versus judgments in another. The whole premise of the New York Convention and why it attracted as many signatories as it did and why it fixed the problems of the prior Geneva Convention was to focus, have every country focus on the award and not on any kind of court proceedings about the award in the originating country. This is a fundamental change in the approach. Congress knew that there could be court proceedings elsewhere. But imagine the case of a U.S., an award in the United States between an American and a Frenchman. It comes down here in the United States, in Washington. They take it to France. They don't seek any activity here. How could it possibly be that Congress wanted or thought that you could evade the 3-year limitation for an award rendered in the United States itself?
But in my hypothetical, you have tried to enforce in the U.S., and you haven't completely been able to recover the amount of your award. So then you go to France. I mean, that's the hypothetical. I don't want to take this much further. Is there anything else that you wanted to
say? On the issue of the waiver, again, I don't think we didn't make that argument because we don't think we have to. But to the extent you saw in our papers any arguments that support the view that the D.C. Recognition Act is not intended for this, clearly there is no other case of a state Uniform Recognition Act recognizing a judgment on a judgment. They talk about looking at the merits, and it's intended for merits decisions. I don't think we waive that point because of the Felter versus Kempthorne case, which I believe in the context of statutory interpretation, if you make arguments and say that there is no entitlement to recognition under the Act, that's sufficient. That's 473 F. 3rd, 1255. I just want to close with one last sentence about this issue of this is that the only principle you should look at is whether this is pro-arbitration or anti-arbitration. Clearly, there was a time limit intended for a reason, for finality, for repose. Congress made that choice. And just as this is one line from the case Rodriguez versus United States, 480 U.S. 522 at 525. No legislation pursues its purposes at all costs, deciding what competing values will or will not be sacrificed to the achievement of a particular objective is the very essence of legislative choice, and it frustrates rather than effectuates legislative intent, simplistically to assume that whatever furthers the statute's primary objective must be the law. There's time limits to bring claims, there are time limits to confirm awards, there are time limits to then enforce the judgments. This is what Congress decided, and it's really not an issue of thinking it should be longer for whatever reason in a particular case.
Can I ask you just one quick fact question? You do not dispute that the arbitration award here is a valid, enforceable award under the convention, just in its own right, not...
Correct, and they could still go to any number of jurisdictions where the statute of limitations is longer, as they have done, to enforce the award today and recognize it.
Thank you, counsel.
I'll be very brief. To address Judge Rogers' concerns, the hypothetical you were describing is exactly the hypothetical we're in. We had an arbitral award in France. We've tried to enforce it there. We've been to the Congo, tried to enforce it there in their courts and by meeting with the government.
Why did you wait so long? Why didn't you file in multiple jurisdictions at once to enforce this award? Why did it take so long to get to the United States?
I can't answer that entirely because my firm has only been involved in this case since 2008. What we were trying to do was to go to the Congo and deal with the government directly there. And this is a...
So you made a strategic choice you knew time limits were out there. Your client knew time limits were out there. And you just made a choice not to go
We confirmed in France, we believed, and it was represented to us in meetings and in other engagements in the Congo that this would be paid. And part of it was paid, but a large part of it was not paid, which led to us looking for other places to enforce it. I think as Judge Rogers is and I'm sure you all appreciate that enforcing judgments or awards against foreign sovereigns is difficult and can take a long time. And it's one of the practical aspects of this that we really want to be able to enforce the awards that are legitimate and that should be enforced. To set up a barrier, I don't think is in the public policy of the U.S., although they're going to comment on that, that there isn't another avenue. And I wanted to get back to Photochrome because I think we read that case differently than you do, Judge Millett. On page 518 of that decision, the Second Circuit said, they had recently held that if an arbitral award actually results in a judgment in a foreign country, it may be enforced as a foreign money judgment in the state of New York, regardless of the limiting provisions of the convention, and subject only to the non-enforcement provisions of Article 53 of the New York CPLR. That's the way we've read this case, as the Second Circuit saying that you're not in the convention when you're in the state judgment statutes, and we thought that case the real dilemma in that case was whether what they were looking at was actually an award or was it a judgment.
In 519, they say voter crime must be given the right to assert the non-enforceability of the award under Article 5.
Yes, that's because they deemed the thing they were dealing with as an award. And they said, go enforce it as an award. It's not a judgment yet. Mm-hmm. And once you've got a judgment, then it can be a judgment. But you have to have a judgment before we can apply the judgment law.
Is there just any material difference at all that you can point me to between enforcing this arbitral award and enforcing this arbitral award? Is there any meaningful distinction that Congress would have thought about?
I think, it's the same amount of money. Obviously, if we got paid on one, we wouldn't ask to be paid on the other one. So it is a judgment enforcing an award.
So is the answer no, there's no meaningful difference?
I'm not sure that there is a meaningful difference in that one is a judgment, and that's what the Second Circuit was saying here. That is a difference, and that's meaningful. Because it tells you what route you're looking at.
Just getting your money. I mean, either way, you're just getting your money.
It's a parallel way of getting your money, but it is a different way of getting your money. It's a harder way of getting your money to go the judgment route.
Why is that?
Because of the streamlined procedures that the FAA allows for. The defenses are actually fewer in the FAA than under the state judgment statutes. You can just bring a petition to enforce the award, so you don't have to go through the complete procedural requirements that you do enforcing a judgment, where you have to bring the complaint, get an answer, have discovery, move to summary judgment. When you're enforcing the award, you just go present award, get a judgment, and it can happen within 30 days, really. In this court, at least. This procedure took much longer, as you can imagine, and there was discovery. So it is a vastly more difficult procedure to enforce a foreign judgment than a foreign award. But they are separate procedures. I think, unless you have other questions, the final thing I'd just like to leave you with is that when you look at the preemption cases and the Federal Arbitration Act cases, the ones that they cite do not have to deal with the FAA for the most part. When you look at how preemption law has been applied to the FAA, you look at something like Ekstrom in this circuit, which these cases are uniform in saying that we're only going to preempt things that interfere with enforcement of arbitral awards. To decide the way the district court has said, basically, you're saying you'd be reversing that view, I think, in the way that preemption's been applied to the FAA.
All right. Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.